So it's friends and colleagues, it's a pleasure to welcome you to this evening's second alumni lecture in economic history. There are many well-known faces and some less known ones among you, and I'm pleased and grateful on behalf of the department that you've made the journey to revisit your alma mater today. Before introducing our speaker, let me say a few words about the life of the department over the past year, since I took over as convener from Mary Morgan. Last year, many of you will have come to hear Professor Nick Crafts deliver our first alumni lecture on steam, electricity, and IT as technological revolutions. Unfortunately, a few weeks after that lecture, Nick Crafts decided to leave us for the University of Warwick. And soon after that, Tom Nicholas, one of our younger and highly talented colleagues, left for Harvard Business School. It is, of course, a great pleasure to know that one's colleagues are held in equally high regard outside the department. There are, however, some unfortunate unintended side effects of this fact. In other words, these departures generated something of a kerfluffle among us, and much of the past year has been spent moderating and rectifying this. Fortunately, we have done so in such a way, it is fair to say, that strengthens our claim of being both the most diverse and wide-ranging and close to the largest department of economic history in the world. Key to this claim is the appointment this February of four new lecturers. This was a once-in-a-generation opportunity to bring new talent into the department and redefine its teaching and research profiles. I believe none of them is here, but I do know that one of them is here to take the bow, so I will mention them briefly by name. Dr. Gerben Bakker is a business historian specializing in the European film and pharmaceutical sectors. Dr. Deben Ma, who is... Deben, thank you. Dr. Deben Ma specializes in Chinese and Japanese economic history of the past two centuries. Dr. Chris Minns works on labor markets and migration in North America. And Dr. Tirthankar Roy is the leading world scholar in the economic history of colonial India. They will be joining the department in September and will be here to welcome you at next year's alumni meeting. Some of you will have been astute enough to notice that two of our new appointees work on Southeast Asia. There are a number of reasons why this is so, besides the excellence of their work. One reason is in every day's morning news. As an economy, so in scholarship, China and India are powers that can no longer be ignored. The second reason is more specific to our department. For the past 4 years or so, the department has acted as a hub for a worldwide network of global economic historians who have met in Europe, India, Turkey, Japan, and the US to debate some of the greatest questions in comparative economic history, namely the causes of the Industrial Revolution, the rise and relative decline, until recently, of the great Asian civilizations, the relations between scientific and technical knowledge, and so on. This project has led to the creation of a new journal published by Cambridge University Press, the Journal of Global History, and has established LSC at the center of a vibrant community of scholars across the world who are concerned with answering those overarching questions. We aspire to continue in this role, and the appointments of Dr. Ma and Dr. Roy will enable us to do so. Let me turn now to tonight's speaker. Patrick Wallace, who joined our department just a few years ago, is a social and economic historian of mainly early modern England. His interests range widely from the economic and social purposes of the guilds or livery companies of London to the social and cultural responses to epidemics, including the most recent SARS scare, to, most saliently, the economic, social, and cultural dimensions of early modern medicine. This is an exciting field, to which Dr. Wallace brings a novel twist by focusing on both the trade aspects of early modern medical activities, tying it into current debates on changing early modern patterns of consumption, and on its moral and ethical dimensions. A combination of excellent social science history methods, diligent historical archive and data research, and lively prose have marked him out quite as a distinctive figure in the field. One of the questions he addresses is how medical and especially medicinal practice was first commercialized. This is a hugely important question. It touches on a wide array of issues: social and cultural modernity or modernization, the definition of professional versus popular medical and more broadly scientific practice sometime between the 17th and 18th centuries, the distinct and distinctive ways in which English practices drew upon continental European and Asian systems of knowledge. This, then, is the theme Patrick Wallace will be addressing tonight. Friends and colleagues, it is my pleasure to ask Dr. Patrick Wallace to speak about when medicine first became big business, trade, quackery, and pharmaceuticals.
Thank you. That was slightly embarrassing. I'm now embarrassed, so I'm going to ask you to just get a little bit embarrassed first as well. Who here has been to see a doctor in the last year? Put your hand up if you've been to see a doctor in the last year. Yeah, come on. Most of you have, right? Okay. Now, put your hand up if you've decided and if you've diagnosed yourself and treated yourself in the last year. If you've had a cold and maybe kind of chosen some paracetamol for yourself or a little whiskey and hot lemon. Good. So we're all... And Tim's put his hand very far up, so I think Tim may be treating himself right now. Okay, so we're all here. We're all pretty much experienced participants in the modern mixed model of medicine, where we've got both doctors who are paid for their services, even though in Britain we don't pay them over directly for their services at the point of sale, and also a continued reliance on ourselves and our families for healthcare. After all, most of the parents here will have treated their children, even if they weren't courageous enough to treat themselves. So the subject of my lecture today is, in many ways, the prehistory of this sector. How it is that the doctor first emerged to play a part in this relationship. How it is that we've gone to the situation, or we've reached the situation today, where the doctor has, in many ways, the upper hand. You know, if we get seriously ill now, how many of us are going to carry on treating ourselves after our initial whiskey and hot lemon? Probably not that many. So how was it that doctors got the upper hand? Well, I'm going to answer a bit of that at least. But before getting onto that, I want to say a few words about the school and the department's engagement with this kind of question. Because both the school and the department have had a long tradition of engaging with questions of health and medicine, beginning probably with the Webbs themselves, among whose many, many works is a rather odd study of public health care called The State and the Doctor, first published in 1910. While more recently the schools developed new initiatives in biotechnology and AIDS and a whole series of other areas of health policy and health research. Within our department, Jack Fisher, known to many of you, although not to myself, identified an epidemic in the 16th century that has since become known as Fisher's Flu. Not many of us have that kind of accolade. We don't even know if actually Fisher's Flu existed, but it's got his name on it. The department seal is on that flu epidemic, should it have occurred. More recently, Tim's investigated the relationship between height and welfare and well-being in the 19th century, while Larry's explored the impact that the Black Death had on the economic history of medieval Europe. So we're a cheery bunch. Now, it's only natural that the LSE should be concerned with these areas. Not only is securing health a major human concern, it's one of the most complicated of economic and political problems. Across the world, that was my initial title page, the bones that you can probably ignore, as you can ignore the plague doctor. Across the world, life expectancy has grown significantly over the last four decades, as you can see here, broken down by different regions' development. At the same time, expenditure on health, at least in the West, has galloped ahead of growth in GDP, rising from around 3.4% to about 9.7% of GDP in this sample of five developed countries. And you can see the US there surging ahead up to 15%. The Americans really do know how to do healthcare. As a result of this change, the medical workforce, doctors and nurses, have roughly doubled in size over the last three decades, while spending on pharmaceuticals has grown by about 50%, from around 0.8% of GDP in 1970 to about 1.2% in 1996 in OECD countries, at least. Meanwhile, Big Pharma, as it's known to its both friends and enemies, has become a significant element in global trade, one of the few in which the UK still has a respectable slice. How to fund this change, and to spread its costs and benefits equally, or perhaps at least more equally than they are at present, are major issues. And so are some of its byproducts, such as the current pensions crisis. Now, persistent growth of this kind is not the only striking characteristic of healthcare in recent years. One of the major changes in health policy and regulation has been the spread of market models and competition in healthcare, a process that appears to have speeded up in recent decades. In the UK, GPs are now expected to be entrepreneurs as well as doctors, and this is a process that's even further advanced in the US. Let me sort my words out there. Now, it's easy to forget how large a change this is. Competition has, in fact, for a long period, been constrained in healthcare. These are three vignettes from the history of American medicine. Basically, the first thing that American doctors did when they became professionalized was set minimum fees. I can understand where they're coming from. It's a nice idea. They were strictly concerned with constraining the market. And this is something that they continue to press for throughout the 20th century. That's a former president of the American Medical Association describing the most despicable character. It's not misdiagnosis. It's not, getting interested in his patients or drinking too much or any of the things that we think that might be problems with doctors nowadays. It's undercharging. Not something that we're commonly concerned about nowadays. It was only in 1975 that the Supreme Court finally declared that minimum prices were illegal. Throughout the history of professional medicine, one of its main concerns has been controlling the free market. And this set norms for quite a long time. Now, what we're seeing today, arguably, is the breaking down, or at least the transformation, because we haven't lost professional controls, of this system. Now, we're still a long way from a free market in medicine, but we're closer than we've been for a while. And one symptom of this is the institutional and economic flux that we're seeing, the new systems, the new public-private partnerships, the new reliance on different kinds of insurance and for-profit as well as not-for-profit health providers, and changes in the perceptions about the acceptability of profit. Profit literally used to be a dirty word in professional medical circles. Now, it's not clearly the case, particularly if the recent figures for GP earnings are anything to go by. If you're going for £250,000 a year, you can't think the profit's an entirely bad thing. Meanwhile, pharmaceutical companies have become world-spanning leviathans. So, medicine now is unquestionably big business. Now, what I want to discuss today, having set up why it's so important, probably none of you really disagreed with to start with, what I want to set up today is the point at which medicine first reached this position, when it became big business. Now, there are three questions, really. First, when did medicine become commercialized? In short, when did people become used to paying for a doctor rather than relying on their family, their friends, their neighbors, or someone who's just down the road and who thinks they might know what to do in the case of illness? Now, what I want to show you in the first bit of the lecture is that this seems to happen in the 17th century, and we'll look at some of the reasons for why it might have happened then. Now, in the middle part of the lecture, we'll be examining the question of what people used as drugs and why people believed that what they used worked. Now, this is the 17th century. On the left, on the right-hand side of the slide, you can see what's known as a bill of mortality. It lists all the things that people were dying of in 1665, mostly plague that week, but also things like, drownings, that's accidental, but rickets, syphilis, jaundice, imposthume swellings, those are. Now, this is simply there to remind us that the 17th century, well, it's an age of scurvy, syphilis, of smallpox, and a whole lot of nasty diseases that a lot of people can't do a great deal about. as well as, of course, being an age of civil war, glorious revolution, Shakespeare and Milton and other more attractive reasons that make you perhaps wish you were there. Well, probably not. Now, like today, the 17th century was also a time of change in medical provision. And towards the end of the lecture, I'll be discussing some of the ways in which the market provided new kinds of medical product to satisfy the growth in demand that we'll be discussing in the first part. Now, in the process, medical entrepreneurs helped develop entirely new business techniques, including things as basic as brands and newspaper advertising. And there we have a nice painting of an Italian quack selling in the marketplace his nice bottled medicines. So, first, take off. Always good to use a phrase that we understand, right? Now, when did medical consumption become big enough for commercial medicine to emerge? Well, there's been doctors and there's been people able to afford them for pretty much all of recorded English history, all of recorded world history, really. But there's not always been a mass market for medical services. In fact, large-scale consumption of healthcare really seems to appear in the 17th century. Now, the best evidence we have for this, going the wrong way, is this curve. Now, we don't have many curves yet. We're still working on it. Now, what's it show? It actually shows how many people owed money to a doctor when they died. Now, you could, of course, take it as evidence for changing success rate, but that doesn't really seem to be plausible. What it shows is a dramatic rise from around 1600, when Queen Elizabeth dies, probably from being poisoned by her makeup, which was a combination of arsenic and vinegar. So around 1600, less than 20% of people owe medicine to doctors when they die, so seem likely to have been using medical assistance at a point of critical illness. Now, by the time Samuel Pepys comes along, here in the mid-1660s, it's risen a bit. It's up to the mid-20s, but it's still not a massive proportion. So Pepys still stands out in 1658 when he has a stone removed the size of a tennis ball. A successful operation, which is good because otherwise he wouldn't have the diary, but sufficiently rare that he has a party every year on the anniversary of the operation. That's what the operation would have looked like. They tied people down, sliced in, and did it in about 15 seconds, which helps, I imagine. Now, by the 1710s, however, when Queen Anne dies, we're up to over 50% of people in this sample who are paying for medical services before they die. Now, Queen Anne dies of the gout, and her body is so swollen that she needs a virtually square coffin to be buried in. So they hadn't got much of an answer necessarily, but they were definitely spending more on doctors. Now, of course, Queen Anne, Pepys, and Queen Elizabeth even were all spending money on doctors throughout this period, so this is starting from a basic level of participation, but the evidence for the expansion in purchasing is pretty good. Now, okay, the data's for Kent. People from Kent may not be the best examples, but it's the best that we've got thus far. And I want to do more, but I haven't yet got the money for it, so hey. Now, if we've got this nice curve, the question becomes, well, why? Why in the 17th century did people start buying more medicine? Why did they start being willing to pay doctors to treat them? Now, the best explanation that I've come up with so far, and I'm still working on this one, seems to be a mix of factors, best described initially as structural change, reaching for the good economic history concepts there, because England's becoming significantly more urbanized in this period, as you can see from the figures there, from only 10% up to about 17% in 1700, and as a result, or connected to this, it's becoming more specialized and more, more urbanized, of course. I just said what I was going to say. Now, in addition, it's seeing changes in taste. Changes in taste, why should they matter? Well, in part because Italians and people living in France particularly had been used to using doctors for far longer than the English. In fact, the really quite patchy and poor evidence we have are that the Italians were enthusiastic medical consumers a good 100 years before the English were. So changes in taste seem to account for at least part of it. The British wanted to be like the more sophisticated continental sick. Now, each of these developments seems to have played a part, as best I can tell, in the increasing tendency of people to buy medical care rather than rely on family and friends. Now, measuring their respective impact is, of course, a problem that I have not embarked upon yet. But what is striking is that the English are not getting much richer in this period. Now, these are the best, and they're not that good, the best recent figures for real wages in this period. And there are best trends, and we won't get into the details because people get hot under the collar when we get into the details of real wage series. But what do they show? Well, they show that England's seeing some growth in wages. You can see the top line shows that London's actually fairly well paid. Londoners are fairly well paid and are getting slightly better paid between 1600 and 1700. But they're not getting massively better paid, and they're still only catching up with their real wages from around 1500. Yet, there's no evidence that English consumption of healthcare was similarly regaining ground lost in the 16th century. So real wealth, real wages may have played some part in this, but it's not that the English are somehow getting richer and so deciding to spend more money on medicine. And in this, there are some interesting parallels with today. Now, this little scattergram shows the share of GDP spent on health against per capita income in 2002. Now, as you can see, there is a broad trend upwards. Not a very clear trend, but a broad trend upwards, so that richer countries spend a bit more than poorer countries. But the most striking thing is the range, that at all levels of wealth, countries spend quite strikingly different proportions of their GDP on healthcare. Now, the reasons for this modern phenomenon are widely debated and seem to be most strongly linked to the structures through which healthcare is provided, whether the state, non-profit, or privately funded. It's no surprise that America's mix of private and state funding is the most expensive. And also, it's also related to countries' access to the international market in pharmaceuticals and skilled medical labor. Can it rely on access to generic drugs? Must it pay full whack? Can it train and retain doctors? Retaining doctors and nurses being one of the crucial issues at the moment, and so on. Now, something similar, well, broadly similar, seems to happen with commercialization in 17th century England. That expansion in consumption, that surge in graft that I just showed you, occurs in parallel with some striking structural changes in the supply of healthcare. Now, there's not an obvious increase in the supply of doctors, which in itself suggests an interesting story about the changing productivity of doctors that I'm sure the health secretary would be interested to learn about. However, there is a major shift in the linkages between England and the international supply of pharmaceutical drugs. Now, it's a nice little graph that I put together last summer, and what it shows is that over this period, over the 16th and 17th centuries and into the 18th century, a lot more pharmaceutical drugs are being imported into England. Now, every point on this line represents roughly a day spent in the PRO, and some towards the end represent other people's weeks of effort, some of them being in the audience, for which I'm very grateful. Now, obviously not all drugs are imported, but many were, including many of the most desirable ones for reasons that we'll get into a bit later. And this only shows volume. We haven't got a price series yet. That I'm still working on, and it's going to be an absolute beast to finish. But it does show something about the changing availability of the key constituent in commercial medicine. And my suspicion at this point is that this whole change is at least partly supply-side driven, because this is the great period of expansion in international trade, of the opening up of the Indies and the Americas through the East India Company, and so on. Now, what does the graph show? It's clear that it shows a pretty massive expansion in the availability of pharmaceutical drugs, from basically almost nothing up to really quite large amounts, over £100,000 at the constant price by the mid-18th century. But that doesn't necessarily prove the existence of mass consumption. But for these drugs, we can do some back-of-the-envelope calculations to show how many doses were being imported at this point in time. Now, I wouldn't necessarily recommend using 4 drams of senna as a laxative, but that was what people used at the time. And if we do, if we chart that out, we can see it going from around 21,000 doses imported in the mid-16th century to a grand 500,000 by 1700. Now, the population goes from about 4 million to around 5.5 million over this time period. So we're going from really not that many doses to, well, 1 in 8. You know, that's not bad. It's probably not going to reach everyone, but there's quite a lot of Ex-Lax available. Now, at the same time, there's a marked change in the availability and distribution of medical products, a surge in widely available, kind of over-the-counter products, which I'll turn to in part 3. But this is part 1. What I've shown so far, or tried to show, is a set of data that argues for a massive expansion in medical consumption in the 17th century, in many ways a revolution in medicine. And it seems that this was tied to increasingly available drugs and perhaps to increasingly cheap and affordable drugs. And this, it seems, equates to a degree, at least a degree, of mass consumption. But what we've not gone into yet, and this is what part 2 is about, is the obvious question. What on earth were they doing? Why did people want these drugs at all? Now, when we talk about early modern medicines, we're not talking about consuming more bread or more beer, admirable ambitions, I think you'll all agree, or getting a taste for tea and tobacco, one of the other major changes in British life in this period. Drugs are quite a different kettle of fish. After all, early modern food worked. Early modern medicine, well, it surely didn't, right? Well, certainly if you ask most doctors or pharmacists which were the first drugs that worked as curative agents, well, they'll probably mention penicillin, first isolated in 1928, and first used in 1941 on a London policeman, of all people. Or they might, if they're really clever, mention salvarsan, which is first identified by Paul Ehrlich in 1910 and is used against sleeping sickness and syphilis. I don't know why they're alliterative, but drugs often seem to be. And these pharmacists and doctors, they wouldn't be entirely wrong, but they also wouldn't be entirely incorrect. And that's not just because of the placebo effect. Now, this is a list of some of the drugs imported in the largest quantities in the 17th century. Rhubarb, worm seed, opium, scammony, senna, sarsaparilla, aloe socotrina. And you see a good rhubarb there. As you notice, it doesn't look quite like the garden rhubarb because it's Turkish rhubarb, not the common or garden rhubarb. Also, it's better, apparently, if it comes from Asia. Well, these are the things. Now, the most popular drugs, appearing in by far the largest quantities in import lists. And of these, all of them, every single one, is still being regularly prescribed by doctors into the 1930s. In fact, several are still in use today. Opium, senna, aloes. Now, this isn't to argue that all early modern medicines are effective and are still used. Some turned out to be poisonous, always awkward. Others simply proved to be useless. Some became more popular as food, drink, cosmetics, or narcotics. Rose essence, frankincense, chocolate, tobacco, all of these are first used as medicines and later become popular for other reasons. Yet the persistence of this group of popular drugs does make the point that it's wrong to imagine that effective pharmacy begins in the late 19th or early 20th century. Still, the question stands. It's not whether they're used, but what are they used for, surely? Yeah, there we are, in case you didn't hear me. And here we do find a difference. In fact, the key problem with early modern medicine was not that it didn't have drugs that worked, but it had drugs that worked in ways that, so far as we can tell from what we now know about their effects, were largely irrelevant or unhelpful for the problems for which they were applied. Now, before we go on, does anyone know what these drugs mainly do? Ignore opium, because I can imagine that everyone knows what opium does, right? Any guesses? Okay, I'll have to show you. Sometimes people have a good sense. They tend to be herbalists, but I don't think we have any in this audience. Okay, so what are they used for? Now, here's a gathered list of their purposes. Okay, starting at the bottom, opium sedative, fairly straightforward, so we know that. Worm seed, well, it's an anti-worm treatment, still is, although slightly too strong for modern tastes. But the rest, they're all purgatives of different kinds. They're all essentially laxatives or vomitories. Now, there's obviously a bit of a pattern here. With the exception of opium and worm seed, all of these have a very visible and quite drastic, depending on your dose, physical effect. So medicine definitely works, right? And it's an effect which is largely best dealt with in the privacy of your own lavatory. And you should remember at this point that this is an age without your own lavatory, with chamber pots and open gutters down the middle of the streets, so people would probably know when you're ill. But these medicines, for all of that, they still work. Yet, the problem with this approach remains pretty straightforward. It's all very well to have an effective laxative, but it's not going to have done your patients much good when you give it for madness, poor sight, scabs, itch, falling sickness, what's falling sickness? I forget what falling sickness is. I'll remember in a moment. Pardon?
Dropsy.
Yes, dropsy, definitely one thing, but there's another thing which comes under falling sickness as well. The essential point is that a laxative, well, good as a laxative, but less good perhaps for some of these things, at least as far as we understand at this point in time. And again, opium and worm seed remain exceptions to this. Now, the vomits, stools, and so on that these medicines produced were, to be fair, the effect that doctors sought. They knew what they wrought on their patients. But they also anticipated wider benefits from these rigorous purges. And it was these other benefits that we need to understand if we're to explain why they use both these popular imports and the far wider range of unusual drugs, shall we say, that were employed at the time. Drugs such as these, toads, millipedes, bezoar stones, found in the stomachs of goats, human flesh, cinnamon, not often seen in medicines nowadays, mercury and such like. Or why they engaged in generous therapeutic bleeding, a 19th century painting, not quite to the point, but makes the point, rather. Now, therapeutic bleeding, not used very often anymore, but incredibly popular in the early modern period. Now, bleeding, all of these drugs, were used in medicine for thousands of years, literally over 2,000 years. So why did people believe that they worked? Now, at this point, it's worth emphasizing that almost any kind of medicine, from magic to knee surgery, will have some success. Bodies heal. Bodies heal themselves. And the placebo effect, to the extent that it exists, may help further. Indeed, bodies' ability to heal themselves probably accounts for around 20 to 70%, depending on which study you read, of modern medical success. So, pre-modern doctors, we can presume, will achieve something like the same hit rate, no matter how good their medicines are. But the success of early modern medical thought wasn't just because it had an effect, a placebo effect or anything like that. It also had a well-developed set of explanations for why it worked, and these certainly didn't include the placebo effect. These people believed their medicine worked, and they had good logic and experience behind them. And this is where we get into issues of belief and perception. And what I'm going to try and do is explain why it is that these things were used and how it is that you might have been able to use them yourselves. In fact, I'm going to show you how you use them. Now, we're going to begin with Galenic medicine. This is named after the Roman physician there on the left, Galenus, nicely Romanized, who systemized classical medical thought, the main source for which was Hippocrates, who's in the middle. He probably didn't look like that. Now, Galen's ideas dominated medical thought for the next 1,500 years or so. And even around 1700, to become a fellow of the College of Physicians, the Royal College of Physicians, which still exists, still is one of the major regulatory bodies for English medicine, basically what you had to do was comment on Galen's thought. You had to read his book and you had to be able to explain it to people. Now, Galen's ideas were dominant, it's based on Hippocrates, but when it came to medicines, they tended to rely on Dioscorides, who bizarrely is represented as someone from the 15th century on the right-hand picture. I'm not entirely sure why. Now, all of these people were inhabitants of Rome in the 1st, 2nd century AD. Some of them, well, Dioscorides was originally Greek and Hippocrates is Greek and goes further back. And one consequence of this was that English medicine relies on things imported from the East Mediterranean. Importing a set of medical ideas from the East Mediterranean, you import its pharmacopoeia with it, which is one of the reasons why imports are so important. But that's by way of a digression. Now, how did these people believe they identified medicines? Nowadays, scientists trying to identify potential drugs screen chemical or organic compounds in incredibly laborious, incredibly time-consuming ways. They literally try them out, one after the other, in different experiments. There are no equivalent laboratory trials in the 17th century. Instead, there are three key ways drugs enter the pharmacopoeia and become popular: appearance, experiment, and experience. Now, I put experience last because it logically occurs only after people are using a substance. But it was responsible for the uses of drugs evolving and changing over this period. And this is helped in the 17th century by people publishing case histories, literally collections of case studies in which they've treated people successfully. This is a case of a pregnant woman who's vomiting, has diarrhea, and is treated by a mix of wine and acid, vitriol, successfully. Treated by Shakespeare's son-in-law, interestingly enough. He gets quite a buzz from publishing these things. He does quite a number of them. Yet the problem remains. Got experience. The problem remains. Why do you decide to try a plant, mineral, or animal in the first place? Why go to a particular shrub or millipede or whatever takes your fancy? Imagine yourself in the countryside. You're ill. You're surrounded by plants, organic matter, animals, an almost infinite variety of possible things you could try and treat yourself with. Where do you start? It's a bit of a tricky question, isn't it? I mean, where do you start? The world's your oyster. Bit of mud. You could go with mud. You could try leaves. You could experiment. Now, you could experiment, or you could use a bit of logic. You could use some of your knowledge. Now, you have one advantage, at least your pre-modern peers did. You know that God created the world and put all that was in it under your dominion. As one French doctor, Jean de Renou, put it quite clearly, nothing grows, nothing swims in the seas which cannot be used of for human remedy. That's in translation, obviously. Now, this changes the game. This kind of belief about what the world is literally changes your understanding of what its potential is. Finding a medicine's no longer about choosing where to start, but it's about deciding what use each and everything has. Now, this is why early modern pharmacopoeia are so big, because literally everything's in there. It's just a matter of deciding what you're going to use it for. Now, here God helps again. If you look hard at things, they tell you what they're good for. They contain clues. Now, this is the doctrine of signatures. It's a nice name, isn't it? So, this conveys the essential idea. A plant which is bright yellow, such as goldenrod, is rather good against the jaundice, because jaundice turns you yellow. You can see the logic. You can do the same with leaves, with plants, with roots, and so on. So, we've got a couple of ways forwards. But this isn't the only way to discern the effects of medicine. It's probably not even the most important. But to understand the other way, which we'll get to in a moment, I first need to explain how the early modern body works. It doesn't work like our body works, but so we need to understand how it works before we can go on. Now, ideas of the body aren't fixed in the 16th and 17th centuries. This is the period when we start to get really detailed anatomies. That's Vesalius on the left-hand side, where we have people like William Harvey, who discovers the circulation of the blood. So ideas of the body aren't constant. But the core of the ideas of medicine remain Galen's ideas, that Roman physician that I mentioned a moment ago. Now, his view of the body and illness focused on the state of four fluids, essentially. four liquids that ran around inside your body. Yellow bile, black bile, that's around the liver, phlegm, well, we all know what phlegm is, and pure blood. Pure blood because the blood in your vein is a mixture of all of these different liquids, which are known as humours. So it's called humoral medicine, not because it's particularly funny, just because it is. It's always a bit confusing telling undergraduates about that. They think you're going for a joke. You're not. It's hard to work with. Now, each of these humours is linked to one of the four elements. There are only four elements in the world. This is Aristotle we're talking about. So fire, air, earth and water, fire, choleric and so on, you can see roughly from this chart. And when you're ill, your humours are unbalanced. And when you're well, your humours are balanced. It's quite a nice idea. Everyone has their own balance of these different liquids. That point of balance is your temperament. Now, this varies. For the young, it tends to be quite a hot, wet balance. For the old, it tends to be cold and dry. For scholars, it tends to be cold and dry. So we're a little desiccated as personalities. I don't see where they could have got that idea from. Now, this system, with its incredible logic, this idea of balance, suggests what we might term the great principle of treatment. If disease equals unbalanced humours, well, what do? You try and rebalance the body. How? You get rid of the excess, and you counter the humour that's in excess with its opposite. Now, this kind of makes sense for why it is that they bleed, why it is that you focus on purges, on vomits. It's because you're not simply trying to irritate your patient. You're trying to get rid of the excess of whatever's making them ill. So you might bleed in the thigh to remove a certain amount of bile, for example. Or around the lower back, you might put a leech around here to get rid of some choler around the liver area. Now, you're helped in this because you have a medicine of opposites as well. All those drugs that were being imported, well, they have the same kind of quality as your humours. Useful. A drug can be hot or cold. It can be dry or wet, just as a humour can be hot or cold, dry or wet. And they're hot and cold in different degrees, literally a ratchet scale from 0 to 4, from almost imperceptible to very strong. Now, that's all very logical, right? You're ill with something hot, you need something cold. But how do you identify what's hot and what's cold? Now, this is where we get to play participation. What we're going to hand around now are not laxatives. I always feel the need to emphasize that. Now, you'll recognize some of these, because I'm not allowed to use anything poisonous or terribly unusual. So, someone should give one to Larry as well. I need to see my convener doing this. If you know what it is, don't spread the joy, because it's good to try these things blind without preconceptions. Now, how are we doing in terms of passing them around? We're doing okay. Now, once you've got your drug, what do you do? Well, it's very, very simple. You don't find a microscope. Totally useless. You don't find a test tube. What you do is you stick it in your mouth. Suck hard, chew a bit, particularly with the sticks. Look how large that one is. I'm not going to be able to get very far in that one. And think, is it hot or is it cold? Is it dry or is it wet? You need to demonstrate with this, but I should have used a smaller one. And tell me what you think. What are you thinking? You're having sticks. No. Now, do you think it's hot or cold? Hot? Very hot? Medium. Medium hot. Yeah, medium hot. Now, the trickier one with the stick, I think, is it dry or wet? Oh, you think it's both, but it can't be both. I mean, it's got to be one, right? No, it's actually dry.
depending on who you read, and it's dry, but not very dry. In fact, it's not wildly effective as a medicine, but it's still widely used. Now, who's got seeds? Has everyone tried them? Go on. I haven't got one, you see. I didn't put. Couldn't lose a seed in your pocket. Go on. Even if you guess what it is, go on. Dudley Coward. It's terrible. Seeds? Hot? Very hot or mildly hot?
Very.
Dry? Yes. Yes. Okay, this is the basic principle. You have just done your basic pharmaceutical assay. Now, pre-modern pharmacy doesn't get much more complicated than that. Now, the sticks, who knows what they are? Licorice, yes. It's good. Not many people, it's interesting, only about half the people in most audiences recognize licorice at first sight. Now, these are apparently good for disorders in your breasts or your lungs. There you are. And they're only hot in the first degree and dry. Okay. Now, the seeds, well, what are they? Yes. I just had to throw peppercorns in because it makes me laugh anyway to watch everyone try them. Now, they're hot and dry in the fourth degree, both of them. But they're good against poison. Keep that in mind next time you put some pepper on your pie. And they're also good at easing pain, apparently, which I think must be on a slight principle of distraction. But you can see here there is a logic. There's a basic idea about what you do. You find your drug, you get a sense of its qualities, and then you'd use it to treat the opposites. Now, it'd be much more obvious if I gave you one of the laxatives, but I wasn't allowed to. Okay. So we now have some idea about what medicine is and how we work out how to use it. Now, what we're going to turn to now is the question of pharmacy and profit, the more economic history bit of it. Now, because you're all experts at Renaissance pharmacy now, thanks to your sticks, it's time to tell you the bad news. Your skills aren't likely to make you rich, at least unless you have very generous customers. The kind of medicine I've just been discussing is bespoke. Each therapy has to be tuned to the individual and their ailment. Because after all, you have to find their temperament, and you have to focus on getting back to that particular point of balance. Now, it also uses such a wide variety of drugs that even wholesalers struggle to dominate markets. In short, there's relatively little room for economies of scale or mass production. Now, some of you who've worked very hard at these, may be good enough for Medicine Savile Row, but even then you won't have much room for a diffusion line. Now, there is, however, another way to do medicine. And this is where we see the potential for medical enterprises to expand into big business. Because early modern medicine was not just the product of Greek and Roman rationalism. It included a healthy dose of magic, of astrology and alchemy as well. It also encompassed a number of radicals who were developing quite different ways of thinking about the body. And these two sets of impulses come together in the mass production of a group of elixirs, of tonics, specifics and cure-alls, medical products that did not need to be cut to the individual's taste, but offered the same promise of a cure for everyone. Now, some of these medicines have quite long roots. One specific for poison, known as theriac, supposedly dates back to Nero's times. And here you get, this is an illustrated capital from the 15th century manuscript, and you can see the jar of theriac in the left-hand side. And you can also see the chap who's been making it with the vipers, which are its main ingredient. No wonder it's so good against poison. On the right-hand side, and these chaps with vipers actually were very common in Italy's marketplaces in the 15th and 16th century. You see them in paintings if you look quite hard. Now, theriac, that goes back to Nero, so quite a long lineage. But in the mid-17th century, people start to develop new ways of packaging and distributing their secret remedies, their private knowledge, in a way that allows them to sell them at a distance and reap the profits of their knowledge. They became, in short, proprietary medicines, something which is often better known as patent medicines in modern times. Now, these are literally everywhere from the late 17th to the 20th century. They're drugs, often pills, elixirs, and ointments, for which the ingredients are kept secret from consumers. This makes them rather different to traditional drugs, often called ethical drugs, where you have to know what's in it before it can be prescribed. Now, one result of the secrecy is that the producers are often accused of being quacks. And you get a lot of satires of people with large heads and rather dubious-looking bottles of the kind that you see there. Now, no doubt some people who make proprietary medicines were, maybe even still are, quacks. But in their early years at least, quite a few were among the most respectable of doctors, members of the Royal College of Physicians, leading surgeons, apothecaries and such like. In fact, kings, queens and so on as well. Why a king or queen should be good at medicine, I'm not entirely sure, but apparently they were in early modern times. Now, what kind of thing would they be? Here's a classic example. This is Daffy's Elixir, which I've worked on at some length. It's on sale from the 1660s through to the 1930s. And what's it got in it? Senna, our old friend Senna. Elecampane roots, various other roots, bit of licorice, appropriate enough. And it's all in a base of proof spirits. Brandy initially, later just proof liquid. Now, there are two points that need to be made about this. First, despite the secrecy around the recipe, these are all standard drugs. In fact, it's a pretty standard recipe, actually. And the second point is that this would work. This would work both as a laxative, but also as a bit of a pick-me-up, because of all that senna and all that liquor. Now, whether it achieved its aims of curing the gout, green sickness, or any of the other multitude of things which it was initially sold for, is somewhat irrelevant because it did have that initial effect. Now, I've not tried to make Daffy's Elixir. I'm not sure I want to. But we do have... we do have a different example. I'm going to come over here. I need three volunteers. Again, this is not a laxative. It is in a base of alcohol, so please don't be teetotal, and probably you shouldn't be allergic to nuts and seeds. Now, the glass is slightly coloured because they're all I had, but you should be able to see, get some sense of its... that's quite a lot. Its colour. So come on, who's going to be brave enough to try an authentic... well, it's not from the 17th century, but it is a recipe from the 17th century. Fortunately, this was produced more recently. I'm going to need some volunteers. Come on. Come on. No.
Very good.
No. Well, some academical. Probably no one who can do you much use. There we are. So who's being terribly brave? No. I just want to get your sense of how you feel once you've taken it. It's not. Very pleasant, a distractor from life. Bang on. Chartreuse. Green chartreuse, also known as an elixir for long life. I kid you... pardon?
Sorry.
Yes, or a short life, depending. Now, there's some in the jug. Now, this may sound silly, but the recipe for chartreuse was given as a great secret to the Chartreuse monks in 1605 by a general under Henry IV, one of the French kings. And it's kept as a secret to this day. We still don't know what's in it, but it is initially a medicine, and it's used and sold as a medicine until, well, the mid-18th century, when people start to realize it's nicer over ice. Now, it's an elixir. It's a tonic. And drinking it, you get some sense of how it could make you feel that you're living a bit longer. It's also got a range of some of the classic ingredients. There's clearly a few of the classic seeds from early modern medicine in there to give it its flavourings. Now, it's not just chartreuse. If you want to taste this at home, you could try Kemmel, you could try Benedictine, and there's a few other... If you go to the Netherlands, there's lots of elixirs still on sale, aren't there? Now, that's because they taste rather good, and, well, they help get through life. But I'm going to move on from the elixirs before I get distracted. Now, back to the economic history of this. The business potential of these medicines is not so much their ingredients or indeed their flavour. But the fact that they could be marketed and distributed widely, this is because they're general medicines. But it's also because their manufacturers develop a new kind of business model for their wares. But they advertised. There's the advertisers. This is literally among the very first newspaper ads in Britain. It dates from the 1660s. There's been ads for about 10 years before. Among early modern ads, about half are for medicine, about half are for books. It's drug sellers. They're not terribly attractive ads, but it's drug sellers. In this case, for Pearcy's lozenges, I wasn't going to bring those. Things like this, which really develop advertising for the first time. Not only do they advertise, they create brands and package their wares in a branded way. These are early modern drug bottles. You can see just about here, it says Turlington's Balsam, stamped on. It's a mid-18th century. This says Dolby's Carbamazepine. It's stamped onto the bottle. These are the first kind of products which are packaged in this way. Seems crazy, right? Everything now is packaged in nice packaging which tells you what it is, which presents a brand, almost everything. But these were among the first. And there on the left, you can see the Elixis Lutis pamphlet. That black dot is a wax stamp, which you're meant to check against the wax stamp on the bottle to see that it's authentic. It's important to get your authentic elixir. There's several people who are counterfeiting it. And actually, the counterfeiting is why they seem to get into branding in the first place. It's not because they think, oh, brands, that's a good idea. It's because they think, oh, damn, someone else is making my elixir. Best protect it. Now, so they advertise, and they also do product placement. Goody Two-Shoes, common phrase, actually a children's book from the early 18th century. Children's book published by someone who also produced medicines. And the heroine, well, her father dies because of the absence of Date James's fever powders. It's a little unfortunate, I'm sure you'll agree. So product placement, probably the first example, and it's a medicine. Now, on the back of this, they distribute them internationally. And here's some sense of the sales of Daffy's Elixir and their destinations in the 1680s. It's pretty much the first product of its kind to be reaching an international market. Lots goes to Jamaica and Barbados, bits goes to Goa, lots goes to Amsterdam. The Dutch really like their medicines, and a bit goes to America and various other places like that. Now, these ideas, product placement, international distribution, advertising, may sound simple, but they were slow to perfect and slow to spread. Now, once developed, manufacturers could use them to reap quite large profits. And as they did, other sectors began to adopt these ideas. But there's a very long lag, a surprisingly long lag. And in this case, we can see some of the ways in which medicine was a sector in which commercial ideas were reshaped, developed, and advanced in new ways. In some ways, something we can still see, if you think about the role of pharmaceutical companies in pushing new ideas about patent law, about the protection of ideas, and so on. Now, the peak of the proprietary medicine trade was really the 19th century, and I mention this because the Royal Holloway College was founded on the back of one. Holloway's pills are one of the most successful of proprietary medicines, and one of our sister institutions in the University of London, funded by it. We'll judge nothing on the back of this. Now, Royal Holloway isn't the only enduring legacy of proprietary medicines. A number have shifted into non-medical consumer goods, as we saw with Chartreuse, as we also saw with Epsom salts, the first medical product to be patented in England, and indeed Coca-Cola. Remember that secret recipe? First invented in the 1880s as a nerve tonic, and on sale initially in drugstores, before becoming more popular as a beverage. Now, that's the end of my main 3 points, but let me conclude with some more general thoughts. A few years ago, not long before he died, Roy Porter published a book about the history of medicine entitled The Greatest Benefit to Mankind. It's a title that captures something of the regard in which medicine is now held. And this evening, what I've been trying to consider is how medicine came to be the force it is in society and the economy, and the kinds of drugs and the kind of beliefs that lay behind this. Now, as I've shown, the great irony behind the rise of medicine is that so much of what doctors did in the past was unlikely to have been much help, beyond at least inducing a placebo effect. And this wasn't through a lack of effort or a lack of intelligence. the human body remains poorly understood even today. So, although there were some exceptions, the secret to the success of medicine until quite recently was actually no great secret. Medicine thrived because of two persistent human characteristics. First, the hardest thing to do is to do nothing. So any treatment, no matter how bizarre, is likely to find some adherence, because it will demonstrate some successes. And the second, the easiest mistake is to assume that correlation equals causation. And this error finds its richest soil in our views of our own bodies, where we really know very little about what's going on. So I'd like to finish by really just thanking God for the blind control trial, which may be helping us beyond this position. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Patrick, for such an enjoyable and probably unique interactive lecture, certainly unusual interactive lecture at the LSE. There is some time for questions, so if anyone would like to ask further details, yes, at the back there. The lady in the red, yeah?
Right. An enthusiast, I'm sure.
Thank you for a very good lecture. Two things, please. Your comment about the treatment had to be individualized because of the imbalance of the four
because of the temperament,
humors.
Yes.
I think even today, without that theory of the four humors, treatment is individualized for the basic fact that each patient reaction to drugs, to pharmaceuticals, is very different. It's well known with drugs like warfarin or the sedatives, morphine, etc. There are patients who it doesn't touch at all, and there are patients who are oversensitive to it, and then there is a whole scala in between. So medicine is still highly individualized. And the second thing is, even to this day, where you can try and convince patients that things do not work, they still want medicines.
Yes.
There has never been a time in medical history than this present time where people are over-consuming healthcare, over-consuming medicines, and still the hardest problem is to try and convince them to do nothing because the body will heal itself.
Yes. I'm certainly not blaming doctors.
I didn't say for medicine.
I think you raise a very important point, which is that whether doctors, in a situation like that, whether doctors know they can do anything or not, people want help. They want succor. And that is one of the most important roles of medicine. And I think there's no way to avoid that apart from probably having a branded range of placebos that you could just hand out. Your point about temperament's very, very right. I mean, obviously, medicine continues to be individualized and is becoming more individualistic with gene therapy. Or at least that's the ambition, right? But I think it's fair to say there is a qualitative difference between our idea of a medicine based, at least in part, on a law of averages and mass trials and this. There's something incredibly tailored about proper Galenic medicine, incredibly tailored and incredibly human intensive, which is very interesting. But thank you very much.
Gentleman in front.
Yes. Can I have your view on the drugs against depression?
Mm-hmm.
You talk about something like Peter Watkins.
Yeah.
What's your view on the Prozac?
But it's not something I'm terribly qualified to comment on, because it's really a question about pharmacological efficacy and there is a big debate about whether or not these work. I mean, I'm sure behind your question is some of the recent literature, recent news stories about, well, talking cures, psychotherapy works as well as most things like Prozac and such like. I should really leave that up to modern doctors, but it's fair to say that the development of that kind of class of drugs does mark a significant advance in some senses. Whether they're wisely prescribed is another question, and whether it was necessary, I think that's probably something that I really couldn't answer.
The
at the back with the Canada shirt.
Is it your view that
humor
medicine doesn't work, or have you found evidence that it does?
Well, it works in the sense that it does things to people's bodies. It works in the sense that people would have been cured by it, at least in part because of the placebo effect, because of self-healing and things like that. It works, aspects of it will work, because some of what they use is effective. Worm seed is effective against worms. Bits of it, like inoculation, which becomes widely used in England in this period, also work. But I think it's fair to say that the vast majority doesn't work in the sense that we might understand now of using drugs that are actually effective against the ailment in our modern understanding of what that would be. So it worked then, but we wouldn't want to use it now, if that's safe to say. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Julia?
That's a very good question. The role of the doctor as a kind of as the controller of prescribed drugs is something which comes in the late 19th century, actually, with the emergence of professional medicine. You have to license your doctors before you can give them that kind of control, and then you have to have various other stages. So in this period, actually, there's no control over medicine. Anyone can buy anything. And because of this, as you suggested, pharmacists and apothecaries really do have a massive role to play in supplying drugs to anyone who wants them, and in suggesting perhaps what they might use in a particular point in time. So it's a far more, one of the characteristics of medicine in this period is a far wider range of people who are involved. It's not just people we'd identify as physicians, but it's surgeons, apothecaries, druggists, booksellers, a whole bunch of people who might engage in selling these things. All of them would have some degree of practice going alongside that.
Carlos.
And the truth is that it works. So, you have explained that this knowledge has been there for thousands of years.
Yep.
Now, the question is, if you're asking, when is this mass produced massive amounts? How do you relate this with the distribution? And I'm talking about the printing press and books and tablets. What is the role of the printing press? And do you find a correlation between
very good point. Very good basic point. Always trust your mother. This kind of process of commercialization does have a strong relationship to print. You're absolutely right. The relationship to print is interesting because it depends what kind of print you're talking about. This happens, 200 years after printing has become widespread. In part because it takes quite a long time before people develop the kind of popular press that supports it, and before people develop adverts, which aren't automatically the first thing you think of when you invent the printing press. They come along quite a long time after. So the press, once it's implanted into the system, is incredibly important in driving advertising, in allowing people to publish pamphlets, in allowing people to advertise. But it takes a long time for that connection to develop, for people to realize that potential. I mean, it also depends, obviously, on literacy and various other issues about access to print, which are vitally important. I mean, it's probably no accident that in England, this expansion in patent medicines and proprietary medicines occurs in the mid-17th century, which is when censorship of the press breaks down, and you get the first newspapers, in many ways as a consequence of this breakdown in censorship, which comes with the Civil War. So you can see some quite direct and quite interesting connections, but it's a bit of a chicken and egg story in some senses, with advertising and such like. Yes?
Briefly, yes. There are many other questions in the...
Okay, well,
Okay. Tim. Yes.
I was wondering if the explosion in medicines coincided maybe with explosion in diseases. There was some, you know, more people were getting ill, so they needed maybe more medicines or something.
Not as far as we can tell. We've got the mortality statistics. I mean, life isn't that great in the 17th century, to be fair. You had a fair chance of dying fairly early, and there's some quite nasty things you'll die of. But it's not noticeably worse than it was in the 16th century, or the 15th or 14th century for that sense. So, I mean, this was the first thing I sat down thinking about this and had a quick look at. And there's not an obvious connection, at least as far as we can tell. You'd imagine there would be, but it just doesn't seem to be that. It doesn't seem to be there. So, yes.
Tim.
Yes. Good question. There would certainly have been a mortality figure associated with some of these medicines, particularly the ones involving large quantities of arsenic or mercury or lead or any of the other things that we now believed or now know to be highly poisonous. No one's ever actually managed to work out a relationship, do figures, which is a bit of a shame, but not terribly surprising given that it's so hard to do anything like that in the period. But you're right, you would expect a fair number of people to die because of the medicines as much as the disease. Yes, it's slightly worrying, but that may well be offset by the placebo effect, and so we have no idea about the extent to which they balance out. So, good point, I should have mentioned that. The killing power of early modern doctors. Yes, potentially significant.
Yes.
The church is massively involved in medicine. Particularly during the medieval period when a lot of medicine is actually monastic medicine. In many ways, the church keeps together a set of medical ideas, and a lot of priests and a lot of monks act as doctors. So the church perpetuates this idea. Perpetuates basic knowledge and basic medical practice. Commercialization doesn't seem to be related to the church. If it were, we'd expect commercialization to happen in the mid-16th century when the monasteries get abolished in England, but it doesn't seem to increase much in that period, at least not as far as we can tell. And commercialization occurs in places like Italy and France, which retain these big monastic centers of healing and big monastic hospitals. So the church is very involved in providing healthcare, particularly in ongoing Catholic parts of Europe which remain Catholic, but it doesn't seem to have much of a relationship to commercialization, apart, obviously, from the monks of Chartreuse, who later turn a profit. So not as far as I can tell, I think, is the short answer.
The gentleman to the... That, yes.
it's not... It's, I guess, under review. Many professional doctors reject it. Some accept that it may be useful. In terms of medical research on homeopathy, there have been some studies, but none are, as far as I understand, conclusive either way, in part because of the difficulty of arguing about what medical studies show. I'm not sure if you can get any homeopathic treatment on the NHS, which is a good measure of whether it's accepted. You can. So there's your answer. You can. Homeopathy is accepted to some extent. Not quite as much as it was in 19th century America.
There are many
doctors that disagree. Yes. If you have conversations with doctors, many of them disagree.
Two last questions. Debbie.
Yep. Yep. That's very true. It's quite interesting that, as far as I'm aware, Chinese medicine develops independently of classical medicine, but the basic idea does have a lot of parallels, as far as we know. And what's interesting is that while the basic ideas develop independently, the pharmacopoeias begin to intersect quite early on, so that a lot of Chinese drugs reach Europe through the Silk Route, and in the 17th and 16th century, there's quite a lot of Chinese medicines being exported to Europe. Quite a lot of the same things are used. So there is quite a strong set of connections, and this isn't a medicine which is Eurocentric in the sense that we might think of modern medicine as being Eurocentric, centered on the West. This is a medicine which happily embraces anything that it might think treats a sickness, whether it be American, Indian, African, whatever. They'll give it a go. Yeah.
So the last question.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Secondly,
yes.
Has quickly become less
mobile? I did a symposium at the Science Museum about a year ago now, which was actually on the subject of quackery, and a lot of the issue for debate was, well, are these modern practitioners quacks? Not? It's impossible to tell whether someone today is a quack, because they're not going to tell you. I'm a quack. Fair enough. So I would suspect that medicine's always going to have a very large number of people who are effectively quacks. But I do think that many people who we might consider quacks, looking at what they do, believe strongly that what they do works. I think this is the problem at the heart of quackery, is that a lot of people don't believe that modern scientific medicine works. A lot of people believe that other things do work, and they're willing to pursue that with incredible devotion and energy. And people, quack or not, have successes. So I think that quackery isn't unanswerable. I would say there's a lot of quackery. A lot of quacks would say there's a lot of good medicine. And I don't think that the volume of quackery has necessarily diminished that much, although it's probably less now than it was in the 20th century. But then, who would define a 19th century quack as a quack? They wouldn't themselves. So does that answer your question? Always ongoing quackery. That's probably the best thing.
Well, I think we should thank our speaker for a very engaging but also deeply serious paper on, as I said, some of the big issues in economic and social history at the interface between economic, social, and history of science. And I think something that shows the sort of, I hope not quackery, that we're engaged in the department. So many thanks, Patrick.